This week on Making Contact.
They're worried about a new strongman emerging.
Like a new strongman emerging using his own militia to impose his will upon the Libyan people.
Libyans overthrew hated dictator Muammar Gaddafi last October, but the country remains chaotic. Armed militias once allied with the U.S. and NATO now attack government offices and engage in extortion rackets. Elections recently took place, but the new government will have a hard time controlling the militias. While the West proclaimed a great victory for so-called humanitarian military intervention, the Libyan aftermath is far more sobering. On this edition, independent producer Reese Ehrlich brings us a special report from Libya. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Dressed in military fatigues and carrying AK-47 assault rifles, the Zintan militia surrounded the building and entered without a fight. They weren't seizing a Gaddafi stronghold. They were taking an oil company CEO hostage. The militiamen demanded extortion money. It was the second time the company had been attacked in a month, prompting one official to tell me, "There's a new Libyan mafia." And Libyans are fed up. Recently, tens of thousands of Libyans gathered around the country to demand dissolution of the militias. Over 60 armed groups compete for power with a weak national government. Here in Benghazi's main square, spokesperson Nadia Nur Mohammed tells me the central authorities have got to take charge.
We want to have government control over the police and army and have them as the official armed forces. We want the government to collect the weapons and eliminate the militias. We want security for the country, and we don't want anyone in power associated with the Gaddafi regime.
Another protester, Abdul Wahab, concedes that the militias won't give up their weapons easily. I ask him, what can the government realistically do?
There is no end-of-term solution just like that. They have to tackle it gradually, and you cannot collect the weapons by force, because that will initiate another conflict that we can't do without. There are some other methods. Instead of giving money to the freedom fighters for nothing, they should give it to them in return for their weapons. The heavier the equipment, the higher the pay.
So a weapons buyback program.
Yeah, a weapons buyback program. The money is squandered anyway, so we should put it to good use.
Others at the demonstration complain about the estimated 25% unemployment in Libya. Strikes and street occupations flare up regularly throughout the country. Protest leader Mohammed Riyad says the government should be helping to solve the unemployment crisis.
We want the government to provide jobs and at a minimum provide unemployment insurance and training programs. We're asking that the government establish a database that includes all the unemployed workers. Then it should start job training programs that can help small and medium-sized businesses.
But other Libyans say economic and political problems are understandable given the short time since the uprising. Ibrahim El Mayat, leader of the NGO Libya Progress Association, comes from a prominent family and recently returned to the country from his home in Britain.
Well, yeah, things are chaotic here in Libya, but you know, what else can we expect 6 months after liberation? I mean, we spent most of 2011 fighting Gaddafi, and we just liberated the country last October. We have a long way to go in a country which lacks proper state institutions, doesn't have a system of government. We have no heritage of political parties or political engagement. Of course, things are not going to be simple. There's going to be a lot of problems along the way, and we're going to face some issues. It's not all going to be plain sailing, but I think we're on the right track.
So the Libyan glass is either half full or half empty, depending on who's drinking the water. But without question, Libya remains a fractured country. It wasn't supposed to be this way. In February 2011, Libyans rose up in a spontaneous rebellion. At first, most Libyans opposed foreign intervention, but the exiled leadership, strongly influenced by the U.S. and European powers, quickly began calling for an outside military attack. The National Transitional Council, the U.S.-backed exile body, exaggerated the dangers of massacres, at one time claiming Gaddafi would kill half the population of Benghazi. Gaddafi's troops did kill civilians when they retook cities during the subsequent civil war, but such huge massacres never occurred. And many dozens of civilians died in NATO attacks. Many Libyans, particularly those living in the eastern city of Benghazi, are convinced that the rebels would have prevailed even without NATO intervention. Interviewed during an outdoor rally, Master Sergeant Hamid Hajazi, a spokesman for Air Force officers in Benghazi, says the rebels didn't rely on NATO for victory.
Even before the French Mirage jets attacked, we destroyed a lot of Gaddafi's planes. We forced his troops back 100 miles from Benghazi. Even if NATO didn't come, we would have destroyed Gaddafi's army. Every day we were repairing more planes and sending them into battle. We had disabled planes, and we made them fly.
If for some reason Gaddafi had succeeded in attacking Benghazi, entering Benghazi, what would have happened?
We would have fought door to door to the last man.
But other Libyans are equally convinced that without Western intervention, they would still be fighting a civil war, similar to what's happening in Syria. Abdul Aziz holds that view. He was a construction worker in London before returning to Tripoli a few years before the uprising. I hired him as a translator and only later learned his fascinating story. Traffic was at a standstill and people jostled one another as we walked through crowded downtown Tripoli. Aziz picked up a Cockney accent during his London exile years. He stands about 5 feet 5 inches tall, with gray hair, and is in his late 50s. But he's one tough fighter. He tells me that back in late 2010, he knew a showdown with Gaddafi was looming. Aziz bought an assault rifle on the black market.
Before the end of February, you know, Gaddafi, he's armed. Is the Libyan on his side, and it's the only way I can get a weapon, just like to buy it from one of Gaddafi's boys. I kept it for about 2 months under the ground, wrapped in a plastic bag, and then on the 20th of Ramadan, we just decided to, when we knew Tripoli is going to be liberated today, because we were like under siege for 6 months. And then we decided that the 20th of Ramadan to come out and do something.
You bought a Kalashnikov
from
one of Gaddafi's supporters.
Supporters, exactly.
And how much did you pay for it?
1,500 dinar.
That's a lot of money.
It's worth it.
All right. So tell me, what was it like when you stormed into his Gaddafi's compound?
It's a happiness. It's a happiness to get rid of one dictator who's been there for 42 years. Nobody can do anything about it. It's a big fight. It was a big fight. A lot of dead people from his part and our part.
And then, so the next day, I know you went back,
and
everybody was looking for guns, and you were looking for paperwork.
I'm looking for paperwork, exactly.
Why?
Because I think I found it more interesting. I want to know what Gaddafi doing in that compound.
And what did you find?
I found a list of Gaddafi's bodyguard. The family bodyguard, and the bodyguard of Muhammad al-Gaddafi, his son.
With a list like that, you could tell who were the top military people involved with Gaddafi.
Exactly, yes.
Aziz kept the original list, photocopied it, and turned the information over to the government for future prosecutions. But the judicial system barely functions. As a result, many of the militias take revenge into their own hands. Aziz describes how, months after Gaddafi's defeat, he found a former Gaddafi army officer hiding in a Tripoli neighborhood.
He was just like growing a beard, and he was shopping in the supermarket. He was shopping, and I spotted him, and I found the boys, and I said, look, there's a guy who was here. So they come and take him straight away.
And so what happened to him?
I think he's still in jail.
But as far as you know, he hasn't had a trial yet.
No, not yet.
Azuz's militia is holding the former officer in a makeshift jail outside Tripoli. Militias are imprisoning many hundreds of others around the country. Azuz argues that the militias are only holding them temporarily.
People doing it now because they want to help, just to help. I don't think they mean to do any damage to anybody.
But such imprisonment without trial has come under strong criticism from human rights groups. It's not clear how many months or even years such prisoners will wait before a trial. Since the end of the Civil War last October, the U.S. has sought alliances with Libya's army officers and militia leaders. The militias are aligned with political parties. Such alliances could quickly develop into a system of warlords, with politicians illegally siphoning off government funds to pay for the salaries and arms of their militias. I spoke with El Habib Alamin, a famous poet, political activist, and official with the Ministry of Culture. He says Libyans are quite familiar with the United States' post-war political manipulations in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Those wars in Afghanistan and Iraq didn't result in improvements for the people of those countries. I think some leaders here in Libya are trying to get Western backing to become the next Hamid Karzai. I don't want Libya to become an ATM for Western oil companies while they abandon the people of the country.
The National Transitional Council downplays such concerns. NTC officials argue that local and national elections show they are serious about building democracy. But Minister of Economy Ahmed Al-Hoshli admits the transitional government has limited powers.
Ours is a transitional government. The next government will decide all important issues. We are setting the laws and stabilizing things for the next government to take action.
I ask Al-Hoshli if the transitional government can stop the armed militias, which have become a power unto themselves. In May, angry militiamen fought a two-hour gun battle outside the prime minister's office, demanding bonus payments for the time they spent fighting Gaddafi. Al-Hoshli sounded almost apologetic about the attack.
They had legitimate demands, but it was not the right way to do it. Libya is seeking to be a country of laws with transparency. People who made the revolution didn't do it to earn a bonus. Most refused the bonus. They returned to their jobs. For the rest of them, there is a mechanism to study who deserves to get the payment.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to a report from Libya, produced by freelance journalist Reese Ehrlich.
There is some good news in Libya, if you're an oil company. One day I drive 45 miles west of Tripoli to the Zawiya oil refinery, the second largest in Libya. Security is tight as we check in at a guard station. To my left stretches the tranquil Mediterranean Sea. On the right is a maze of buildings, pipelines, and storage tanks. Muammar Gaddafi helped inaugurate the refinery back in the early 1970s, and his smiling visage was only recently removed from the walls. I met Khalifa Saleh, the operations manager who has worked here for 34 years. Saleh stops in front of an enormous grid of pipes and tanks. He boasts that the facility has very modern equipment. The refinery even produces most of its own drinking water.
This is to produce water for drinking and for processing it, and mainly for drinking.
Oh, I see. So it's a desalinization unit to turn seawater into drinking water.
That's right. I'd like to have a tour at the township. And our hotel at the township. Let's take a coffee there.
Sure.
Yes, really, it's for us.
The Zawiya storage tanks took a few stray bullets, but the refinery came through the civil war largely unscathed. Salih says he had to persuade both Gaddafi's soldiers and the rebels that they had an interest in preserving the facility.
We have to convince both parties that the refinery, it's for us, for the future generation. I'd like to maintain it safe. It's not the right time to fight around it. Even myself, I talked to them. I said, this is not the proper place to make a conflict, because if there's something goes wrong in Zawiya here, the Zawiya township and even Sabrata may be affected, because we have our refinery, we have our Akakos tanks, we have Brega tanks, we have lubricant storing. So it's like a big bomb, you know.
Yeah, it would be a huge fire if they were bombed.
That's why I explain it to both sides.
So the Zawiya refinery and much of the country's other petroleum infrastructure remained intact. I asked Salih if the refinery's production of gasoline and other fuels has reached pre-war levels.
The production today at 15 minutes after 11, the capacity is 102% capacities for both process units.
So it's over 100%.
Yes, please.
While Zawiya escaped serious problems during the revolution, it faces the same kind of internal turmoil as many other Libyan institutions. In May, refinery security guards complained bitterly of not being paid by the government for 3 months. A group of guards trapped the head of the refinery in his office and beat him up. A shot was fired. Salih says that the guards' anger was misdirected. He says the army, not refinery management or the National Oil Company, was now responsible for paying the guards' salaries.
If somebody is not paid for 3 months, you have to critically do something for it. Yeah. And yesterday, they reached an agreement like this. But anyway, we don't expect that whatever happened yesterday, that some people, they come and force and, you know, come with argument with the chairman of the company, it is wrong. Mm-hmm. You don't use force. You didn't take rights by guns. You only say, state what you need, and we'll take care of it.
Despite such turmoil, Libya's overall oil production is now approaching pre-Civil War levels. British Petroleum announced it will resume exploration again. France, Italy, Spain, Great Britain, and the U.S. are getting their crude. The National Oil Company says it earns $4 billion U.S. dollars a month from selling oil. But Libyans wonder where all that money is going. Ibrahim Ali, chair of an NGO called the Libyan Transparency Association, says the corruption from the old regime is being carried over into the new. He explains that in the old days, European oil companies sold the oil at world market prices, but purchased it significantly below market rates. He says the difference was pocketed by foreign corporations and Gaddafi cronies.
The real price outside is $10, and we find inside the contract, for example, $4 or $3. There's a corruption inside this contract. This difference, they will get it by commission outside, and you don't know. Till now, it's like that, you know, and nobody knows about these things, you know.
El Mayat of the Libya Progress Association, who we met earlier, confirms the problem of ongoing corruption.
The entire system was riddled with corruption. Gaddafi systematically destroyed institutions of state and created this environment which was really prone to corruption, fraud, and theft. And we need to set up a new system, and that's going to take a long time. And until we really get a grip and stop the rot, we're not going to see corruption ending in Libya.
One way to limit corruption, according to NGO activists, is to make the oil contracts public. Mayet says that way the public can compare the terms to see if some companies are getting sweetheart deals.
There needs to be a serious review of old contracts, and we need to put in place a good strategy for future contracts. I don't think anyone can expect to come to Libya and get really favorable terms. The Libyans want to have good terms and do business on their own terms and to develop our country. We don't want to be seen as exploitable.
But foreign oil investors disagree. Ibrahim Lias is an official with Medco Energy Oil and Gas. He welcomes me into a modern office off of one of Tripoli's major streets. Lias says companies don't want their contracts with the National Oil Company, or NOC, made public because it could affect profits.
If we're talking about the contracts between the oil companies and the NOC, that's very, very confidential. There is no third party can read it. And it's confidential because each contract is unique by itself. You don't want even other companies to know about it. Some things they you don't want the public to see it. And those contracts, you are talking about the companies and their assets and their shares and their shareholders. So any news coming about these may affect the shareholders.
In fact, European and American oil company executives complain that they should be getting better terms on their Libyan contracts. After all, they argue, while Russia and China opposed military intervention, the U.S. and NATO countries helped liberate Libya from Gaddafi. I ask Elias what he thinks of that view.
Oh, I agree with that. If we let the things happen the way Russia and China wanted at one time, we will not be free now. It's those who you know, stood beside you, you're not going to forget that. There is no way. Plus, so, this is normal.
But the Libyan public doesn't want to reward foreign governments who, until very recently, had cozy relations with Gaddafi. Al-Amin says, given the history of widespread corruption, oil companies should make their contracts public.
The Libyan people need transparency about the relationship between foreign countries and our government and about the economic contracts. Someday it will come out. If it's secret, the Libyan people will be very angry at the government.
While Libyans wrestle with how to regulate the oil industry, other economic sectors are showing signs of recovery. But it's slow going. On a busy street in central Tripoli, I visited a hole-in-the-wall grocery store. Store owner Ahmed Ali puts money in a cash drawer. He tells me business was disastrous for most of last year. There was a shortage of cash, and banks severely restricted how much money could be withdrawn. Inflation was rampant.
During the fighting, there was practically no business at all. We opened only a few hours a day. There were a lot of shortages, so prices skyrocketed. It's 100% better now because people have money to spend.
While business is better than during the war, the grocer still barely scrapes by. NGO leader El Mayet says that's typical. The civil war increased the disparity between rich and poor. Oil industry executives drive BMWs, while many ordinary Libyans have a hard time buying food.
It's a terrible paradox that Libya is an extremely wealthy country, and yet there's a lot of poverty here, and our national infrastructure is in an appalling state. We have broken roads, poor sewage, terrible schools, poor hospitals. It's really not fair. We ought to be living very well. It's a population of only 6 million people. In the future, Libya's oil revenues should be spent for the benefit of all the people in Libya.
But that's not the view of the U.S. and the International Monetary Fund. The IMF issued a report recently offering many of its traditional neoliberal prescriptions for Libya. The interim government is following the IMF lead by studying how to privatize state-owned companies, encourage investment on terms favorable to foreign corporations, and eliminate government subsidies for basic food items to poor people. The Ministry of Economy is considering eliminating the subsidies. Economy Minister Al-Khoshli acknowledges that complying with Western prescriptions won't be easy.
We have a technical committee to study future policies and changing the subsidies. The study is not complete yet. It's very difficult to suddenly cut the subsidies. It's been part of our culture for 42 years. People will complain.
And that's not all Libyans are complaining about these days. Late at night, men in suits and traditional dress mingle in the Tibisti Hotel Cafe here in Benghazi. The hotel is a monument to Gaddafi-era architecture, with a cavernous lobby and scratchy, overstuffed upholstery. The hotel cafe serves as an informal meeting place for government officials, political activists, and reporters. and no issue is more discussed than federalism. A significant movement based here in eastern Libya now advocates autonomy from the central government in Tripoli. Under Gaddafi, many everyday tasks, such as obtaining a business license, required a trip to the capital. So far, such policies have not changed. Guma Asiati, leader of a pro-federalist political group, calls for a system that would leave purely national tasks in the hands of the central government while devolving power to the regions.
The federal government will be the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Justice, Central Bank, the Army. What's belong to each side of Libya should be ruled by the people of the side itself. So each side of Libya will have their own security and safety and also development. That's what we're looking for.
It's an attractive proposition here, where most of the country's oil is pumped. Earlier this year, a gathering of tribal and militia leaders even declared the region autonomous. But it hasn't had much practical effect because of continuing turmoil throughout the country. The demand for federalism is controversial even here. Virtually everyone agrees that local governments should have more power, but that doesn't mean breaking the country up into federated regions. Fatia Steta is a retired English professor in Benghazi.
I was one of the people who demonstrated against it, because, and there were a huge number, right, in the court square against federalism. The eastern parts need to have their own administration. We don't need to go all the way to Tripoli for any paperwork or, no. And this can easily be done. Local government.
The real debate isn't about government democracy. It's about money. Federalists want the East to take 35% of the state-owned oil company profits, a far larger percentage than its share of the population. Opponents say that will effectively divide the nation. Steta says budgets should be based on need.
Libya is a unified country, unified land. It isn't just the eastern parts that are neglected, and the revenues should be divided equally among all these areas, and all the projects should be given to all these areas.
The federal government should allocate money for roads, for example, anywhere in the country that needs roads.
Anywhere.
Many Libyans hope that the national elections that were held July 7th will help resolve the country's problems. A pro-U.S. alliance headed by former Prime Minister Mahmoud Jibril won the most votes, followed by two Islamist parties. But the elections were marred by serious violence, and it's not clear if the new government will overcome the power of the militias. Back at the Benghazi demonstration, protesters split into small groups and debated the prospects for democracy. Protester Abdul Wahab says elections will probably not resolve the ongoing issues of corruption and armed militias.
So this chaos and this disorganization will have to carry on for some years before we establish a firm nation, nation with laws, a constitution that everybody adheres to. But I'm relying on the factor of time.
Most seriously, Wahab says, Libyans worry that continuing political chaos could produce a new dictator.
They're worried about a new strongman emerging.
A new strongman emerging using his own militia to impose his will upon the Libyan people.
For Making Contact, I'm Reese Ehrlich, Benghazi, Libya.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Abdul Azouz and Omar Al-Mosmari in Libya for arranging interviews and providing translations. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.